Thank you, Jim. My name is Drew Krupp. I'm an alcoholic. My anniversary date is June 6th, 1980. Dan is my sponsor. Bruce, who's visiting here, is a good friend of mine, good long-term friend. I sponsor three guys in the program. I know Dan has a sponsor who I know well, and I know his sponsor. So little by little, I'm doing the right thing. So about me, well, first of all, it's good to be back in New York at a meeting. I was born in Mount Vernon, New York. Spent a year living, year and a half living in the Bronx, and then back to Mount Vernon, and went through elementary school, there. And nothing really wrong with it. I was a kid who kept to myself. My folks were they were both born in Germany and came over right after World War I, and they were still had some of that old European mentality of, spoil the ruler and spare the child. Not that I got whacked a lot, but I got threatened with it a lot. And probably deservingly so, because I was a little bit cranky and rebellious as a kid. Not a real troublemaker, but I would talk back to you. And I've come to know through the steps and time that I have spent in the program was that a lot of the alcoholic attitudes that I grew up with and thought I acquired in growing up with, I had as a young kid. I mean, I was dishonest. I was sneaky. I would lie. I didn't believe in anything really. We were not a religious household at all. And, we just kind of grew up. It was mostly a, I would say, a working class area. Most of the people in the area, were employed, single family houses. We played stickball in the street. You had to scream that there was a car coming and run for our lives at times. And, it was not a bad growing up. It really wasn't. But I felt different. I wasn't as good as any of the sports as my friends. I was smarter than most of them, I like to think anyway. And I just was a little bit on the outside of everything. It's sort of like you're looking through a screen at the rest of the world. And I was just a little different. And I didn't know why. And I did my best to fit in. I'm told I had my first drink at about 6 years old. And it was a mistake. I don't know if any of you guys of the age you remember those bright colored aluminum tumblers that were the thing in the 50s. But my parents had them and they had Manhattans in them, and I finished a Manhattan. And that was my first drink. And, I staggered, I saw double, I threw up, and I passed out. And really, the rest of my drinking was about the same. Not a heck of a lot changed from that. We moved. I finally fell in with a crowd of guys, and we weren't real troublemakers, but we were, sort of not the goody two shoes of any group. We tried to fit in, and we fit in best with ourselves. And just when, friendships was really starting to form when I was, 13, 14-ish, we moved and moved to Mamaroneck, New York. The junior high I was in, eighth grade class, had about 75, 80 people in. And I moved to a school that had 1,600 kids in it. And I was lost. I knew no one, no one at all. I had no friends. I had nothing. And I set about trying to fit in and to try and find a place for myself in this new mess that I was living in. That's what I felt anyway. And somehow, that alcoholic idea of fitting in with some place where people will have you no matter what they are or do, I fell in with a crowd who stole cigarettes, liked to smoke out behind school, drank on every occasion we could possibly drink on, combed our hair funny, and tried to chase women all the time because we were really cool 14-year-olds. You know, and when you start to base your whole life and your reality and your truths about what you learn when you're 13 and 14, it generally doesn't hang together too well as you get older. And school was the last thing I cared about. I was kind of constantly being yelled at for grades, constantly breaking curfew, constantly getting caught. I was sneaky, but I wasn't good at it. And somewhere along the way, it dawned on me, and I don't know, it was 10th, 11th grade or something or other, that if I didn't start to get serious about this crap, I was actually going to have to go to work after high school. And I really didn't want to have to go to work. I was expected to go to college. So I buckled down and bang, you know, here I am on a roll for a couple of years. Dropped all of the old friends and found a whole new set of friends. Didn't stop drinking, didn't stop smoking. And some of these friends were, let's say, I think the term these days people use is dry goods. Marijuana was starting to come around, and sniffing a few other things were starting to spread around in the communities of Westchester County. And I was on the peripheral of that. My best friend smoked a lot of grass, and I didn't. We kind of hung around. Again, we just drank every time the opportunity was there. We would be out there, you know, screwing around, doing something, and getting away with it for the most part. And that was an awful lot of my life of what do I have to do to get through this? What's the minimum I have to do to get away with everything and not get caught, not get trouble, not busted, not grounded, not anything else? I talked my dad into letting me use the car, and I also somehow talked him into buying a Mustang as opposed to a VW, and I have no idea how I pulled that one off. But I loved that little car, and ultimately it got wrecked. Not my fault either. So got through high school, you know, had a lot of different girlfriends in high school for one or two dates, and it really didn't go past that because I would always feel like I had done something wrong and I was embarrassed, or they didn't want to talk to me again, you know, which was the other thing. But I graduated from high school. I got out cleanly, and I was 17 when I got out. I was an October baby, so graduated at 17, and in September, I don't remember what happened that entire summer after my graduation until I went off to school. I had no responsibilities. I did not have to work. We were out partying every night. I really can't tell you what I did, but I know I drank a lot of beer and anything else that we could get a hold of. So, being, you know, the genius that I was at that age, I went to a school in Boston where the drinking age was 21. And I was, you know, when I went off to school, I was 1 month away from being able to drink legally in New York. And there are a lot of solutions to that. I pledged two fraternities at a time because they had parties and there was no drinking age. My girlfriend was 21 and had her own apartment. And I manipulated my way through an awful lot of stuff. I really did. My grades were great. There was a lot of drinking around. There was a lot of drugs around. There was a lot of goofing off going on. Typical freshman, you go and you try and do everything you possibly can do, and then you realize a few weeks later, well, I also have to study if I want to stay in here. And my dad had made it pretty clear to me that he would pay for college once, one try at this. And then I was on my own. And as long as he was writing checks, I figured I kind of had to behave a little. I worked hard at a lot of stuff in school. Also partied hard. Had to get my own apartment because the school did not have very much with dormitories for guys, and that was just a wonderful idea. Roommate I had my sophomore year, we both brought our cars up, and he was in charge of buying the beer for the semester, the quarter. And he showed up at my house with 16 cases of Budweiser pints. 16 cases. So we loaded half of them into my Mustang, and we both took off school with that. And those were gone by Thanksgiving. And it was just wake up, they joke about it in some of the movies, Cheerios with beer. But it's not that bad if you want to drink Budweiser. So that was it. It was partying all the way through. Made a big mistake my sophomore year. And in retrospect, a big mistake. I met a girl who was going to become my wife, first wife. And she kind of didn't care if I drank a lot for a long time. And I did drink a lot for a long time. Ultimately, we got married. We had a couple of kids, and 10 years into that marriage, we got divorced, which I thought was the end of the world for me, but it was really it was a beginning for both of us. But I got out of Northeastern in honors. I went to work for what was then a big eight CPA firm. I worked a lot during school, and I was pretty damn good at my job. When I wanted to, but I still wanted to drink a lot. And I still did drink a lot, but I couldn't do it during the day anymore. And little by little, over the course of 3, 4 years, the drinking at night got really bad. And it got bad to the point where I was having a problem getting to work the next day if I was going. And that didn't cut the ice too much. And they basically invited me to leave. And I went to work for a client that I had hired on the spot, and it was a great job. I was in charge of a lot. I had a couple of titles. I got to do a lot of stuff that I enjoyed doing in accounting and taxation. I didn't have to deal with a lot of the junk and had a good time. But I was still drinking every night to the point of passing out, to the point of embarrassing my then wife. And people were noticing, friends were noticing, neighbors were noticing. And it got to the point where one night she called the police and I was taken off to a little happy farm for a few days. They did not know quite what to do with me. They kept asking me about my relationship with my father, and I just didn't understand why we were going down this road. I mean, my dad and I got along, not great, but we got along. And what was getting in the way of this relationship was alcoholism, nothing else. And it was mine, not his. So there was, I signed myself out after a couple of weeks of relaxation, went back to work, worked for a while. I had two nice long sojourns to a drunk farm up in New Hampshire. They called it the Irish Alps. And 2 30-day programs. I went through it twice. I drank on the way home, both times I left there. But that was where I was really introduced to AA. I had had a guy from AA come to my house, and he talked to me, went to some meetings, and I was told I had to go because I didn't want to sleep outside, and it was April, and it was cold, and it was snow on the ground, and all of that good stuff. And I went to that meeting for a while, and you learn stuff that you from your first meetings. You learn a lot of things that don't sink in right away and don't have significance right away. But one thing I learned from going to that meeting is that I try and be very careful of what I say at meetings. The first speaker I heard was a guy who did. He drank, he did drugs, he did, everything under the sun, and he talked about sniffing and drinking gasoline to get high. And the great alcoholic mind said, "I'm not that bad. I don't really need this yet." Right? And a guy in the rehab I had been in, his second or third time through, he came out and went to make amends to his former girlfriend. Got in a fight with her new boyfriend, beat him up, was in rehab, and he was ready to get out and go to jail. And he didn't listen to a sponsor. And these little tidbits that I picked up along the way started to tell me that I really wasn't doing what, this program wanted me to do. I didn't have any place to live. I went back to live with my parents. It was kind of with the covenant that I was not allowed to drink and I had to go to AA meetings. Well, I still drank. I still lied about it and hid it. I did go to AA meetings. I went to a lot of them drunk. I went to a lot of them really sick. And ultimately, I got tired of people asking me if I had a sponsor. So there was one guy in a meeting named Bill. And no matter what shape I was in, somehow what he was saying sunk in with me, and it really hit me. So I asked Bill to be my sponsor, and we went through the whole thing again. Yes, if you don't drink, and yada, yada, yada. So I said yes, Bill, a lot. And what I discovered I had in Bill was the meanest son of a bitch in the group. Bill was an awfully good guy. He was no nonsense, no bullshit, no games, and I still treated him the same way I treated everyone else. All right. And I don't know where he acquired somewhere in his, I don't know, what he had 15 months of sobriety when I asked him to be my sponsor. I don't know where he acquired the patience that he showed me. And I guess it was the fact that in sponsoring people, sometimes we learn a lot more than we ever can pass on to the people we sponsor. But Bill sponsored me for, oh, I don't know, 8, 9 months before I didn't pick up a drink one day. And here's the unique thing about the relationship I had with him. When I was 13, I lost the sight in my left eye. I had an accident and was driven down to Manhattan Eye and Ear Hospital. And there were a bunch of surgeons who worked on me. And I can use his name because he's long passed. But there was a Dr. Regan there, and he was just a nasty, mean son of a bitch. And guess who I had as a sponsor all these years later? There was Bill, sweet old Bill. He was the guy who operated on me when I was 13, and it was just mind blowing. There was some kind of fate thrown into that whole thing. At any rate, I woke up one day and I didn't drink. And that was my first day. And that was the biggest gift my higher power has ever given me, was waking up one day and not drinking. And I went to a meeting and I started listening. I started really trying to listen. And as soon as these guys recognized that I was not drunk at every meeting anymore, and that I was listening and talking to my sponsor. And a lot of these, we're talking about old timers back in 1980. Some of these old timers had 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. As soon as they sort of recognized that I was here and conscious at a meeting, first of all, I was told I had 6 months of coffee duty. So I had to get there early, buy all the supplies, make coffee, buy the cakes, set up 100 folding chairs on Saturday night. That was our open meeting. And then clean up everything when I was done. And I had a guy working for me with me on this, who stopped coming to meetings like right away. So for a while, I did all of that alone. And then my long-term friend Pete got involved, and he and I did it. And there's another place I discovered how angry people can be coming into this program. When I'm setting up folding chairs one day in a church auditorium, and a folding chair comes flying off the stage on one end and makes it three quarters of the way across the room. And it was Pete just venting one night. And fortunately, none of us got hit. But so I guess I made coffee and set up chairs really well. Because when I was done with 6 months, they told me that I needed another 6 months and I had to work with a newcomer doing it to show him. And I was like, okay. And then after that, they decided that they needed a setup chairman for a year. And that was me. So I didn't really have a night, but I had to be there every night because somebody else might not show up. And then I got the Monday night men's meeting that we had. And then you had to not only set up the chairs and tables, make the coffee, but you had to go to the bakeries during the day because the step meeting, you couldn't buy Entenmann's. That wasn't allowed. It had to be bakery quality. And it was these were the old guys telling me what to do. And they probably had a lot of fun with me at that point in time. But while all this crap was going on and all these games were going on, Bill started me pushing me through the steps. And he would start off with kind of the way I sponsor people. So now that you've been in a program for a few months, do you really think that your life was unmanageable when you were drinking? Yeah, Bill, it really was. Okay. Do you think if you just leave meetings right now and just go about living that your life is going to stay manageable in any way? Well, probably not, Bill. Yeah, okay. Go home, read the first step again, and tell me what you think about it tomorrow at the meeting. And this went on and on and on. And he spoon-fed me the steps going through them. And the steps are the program. And I've learned through a whole lot of years that these steps just make up different parts of one large prayer. I did not come in believing in God. I sort of thought AA was going to be my higher power. At a second step meeting in Larchmont one night, it dawned on me, and this is one of my first 2x4s to the back of the head in this program. And it dawned on me that if I started listening to Bill and to Harry and to Ray O'Keefe and to a few of the other guys who were there, and if I did what they were telling me to do, that I might be able to get some part of what they had. And what they had was a comfort. They had a serenity. They could be gruff and they tell you where you were wrong in an instant, if you needed it. But there was a lot of love there, and it was not It was not the warm huggy, let's go for coffee stuff. It was do this, and this is what you need to do, and then come back and tell me what's going on with it. But my higher power, the beginning of my belief in a higher power, started at that Larchmont meeting that Friday night. What I realized that if I did what they were telling me, that first of all, I could have what they wanted, and secondly, that I was not reading the step properly. I was reading it as if I had to develop a belief in God. That's not what the step says. The step says came to believe in that of higher power, and the step is assuming and presupposing all the way that there is a higher power. And in my life, there had to be, because there was no way that I did any of this stuff to that date on my own. And I was 3 or 4 months sober when this was happening. And Bill and I talked a lot about that. We would, there was a crowd that he sponsored, four or five guys, and we'd go out for coffee after every meeting. Meeting got over at 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night, and still go out for coffee. And we were going through the second step, talking a lot about God and spirituality and what it means. And finally, one guy brought up the third step. He says, "Oh, that's easy. All I have to do is turn it over and then I can start writing." And again, you learn that you've got to judge who you take advice from, because this guy's nickname was Captain Clearhead. And poor Eddie never really did get it all the way, but we were all told, and this went on. We discussed the third step. It must have been for 2 or 3 hours. That all we were doing is making a decision at this point in time. But we're going to make a decision that our life had become better, that this is what we wanted, that we were willing to go further, and that down the end of that road, we could have a spiritual experience and develop a conscious contact with God. And that's what it was. That was the third step. I made a decision that I was going to continue to do what I was being told to do, that I was going to keep going no matter what. And Bill said, "Well, that's great." He says, "Get yourself a notebook and a pencil and go write the fourth step. Start with the words, 'I was born,' and then continue until you got nothing left to say." And I was like, "Wait a minute. Let me think this through again." And he says, No. He says, "You've made a decision. You're not taking that back. Go home and write." And I'm an alcoholic, so it's the first thing I do when I'm told to write. I procrastinate. And guys in the group, again, with all the love that you can muster in a 2x4, you'd say, "How you doing?" And I'd get four fingers waved back at me. And the abuse, just in a loving way, the abuse was just heaped on us. Not just me, but there were other guys going through the same stuff. "How you doing?" Four fingers all the time. So I picked a day. Yeah. Hi, Bruce. So I picked a day and I sat down and I said, "All right, I was born," and I wrote for the entire day. I didn't stop for lunch or dinner. I finished sometime at night. I did exactly what I was told to do. I wrote down everything I could. I did not look back. I did not edit anything. I finished the whole damn thing. It was an autobiography, but I threw in all kinds of other junk. And I'm done, and I've got this pile of paper. And this pile of paper was not what my ego told me I was. I was still trying to be a cool guy, 14 years old, smoking and drinking, that type of cool guy. And I wasn't. I was 30 years old. I was unemployed. I was being sued for divorce, and I was living back in mommy and daddy's house. And the car wasn't running too well. But my ego told me everything was cool. So, and I didn't want anyone to see what was on this pile of paper. This was the garbage that I kept in the back of my head. And this miracle in this fourth step of we take a pencil and we put it on paper, and the crap starts to pour out from the back of our head in our own handwriting with our own pencil onto our own paper. And when you're done, if you look at it, you can't deny that that's what you were. And I couldn't. I couldn't deny that what I wrote down was that's what I was. And I didn't like it. And more than that, I didn't want anybody else to see it or know it. So I put it, wrapped it up in an envelope, put a whole bunch of postage on it, addressed it to my sponsor, put his return address on it so nobody could track it back to me, and carried it around for a day until I saw him at the next meeting. And I gave it to him. And he says, he handed it back to me. He says, hang on to it. Sunday afternoon, we're going to do the fifth step. And I said, Bill, if you give that back to me, I'm burning it and we're done. And he says, okay. He kept it. That Sunday in his office, we did the fifth step. Now, as I said, he was one of the surgeons who worked on me as a kid, when I was a kid. And he had this massive mahogany desk. And he had two little chairs sitting in front of it. And he sat in his massive, gorgeous leather chair. And all around his office, he had these shelves that were mounted like kind of 12, 15 inches down from the ceiling. And there were models and pictures of eyeballs all around his office. And here I am sitting in front of the big desk in the little chair, and the whole room is full of eyeballs looking at me. And, you know, as funny as it is now, I looked around then and it was like, oh shit, I'm in a cult. And I read him my fourth step. And we paused for Coke and to talk every once in a while. And he jotted down a few notes. And little did I know that half of what he was doing was doodling, because he had heard what I was telling him before. And we finished, I had a list of character defects. We got there at 1 o'clock. We finished just in time to drive to our 8 o'clock big book meeting. But he was doodling on the bottom of the page, and he had written down some defects and a few questions. We went over those. And he says, okay, listen, we got to get to the meeting so you can set up. So I didn't get that go home and sit in a quiet place and reflect and all of that. It was like, go fix the freaking chairs. And that's what we did that night. Now, then we went out for coffee afterwards. Then I got home and I was like a limp dish rag. I was so emotionally drained from all of that stuff. But, you know, from that first day, and certainly from the day I did that step, I have never, ever had a desire to drink again. I felt the need to run away again. I've, you know, life has gotten really gooder and gooder. I had this issue when I thought I was finished with the fifth step of knowing the difference between, I'm not sure how I put it in words. I understood this stuff on an intellectual level. That was fine. I heard people talk about it in meetings, and I could see where they, yes, they had these defects. And I didn't get a gut feel for any of this. So it took some time to see these defects run me around and beat me up and everything else. And when they did, after a while, I went back to Bill and I said, hey, what about this? What about this? What about this? And he says, you really want this stuff gone? He says, it's time for you to do a seventh step. Go home, get on your knees, say the seventh step prayer, and then start writing your eighth step. And I did it. I went home, I got on my knees, said the seventh step prayer that night, and I had a split second of absolute pure the peace. I don't know what else to call it. It was a moment I have never had before, and I have never had since. It was better than any high I've ever had. and it was there for an instant and it was gone. And to me, it was telling me, you're going to be all right, Drew. This is what there is for you in the future. Don't drink and go to the meetings. And I said the seventh step prayer again, hoping this was going to come back. Didn't come back, never has. But that was another instance of getting the 2x4 to the back of the head that I really needed. And there have been a few others. And I went through the rest of the steps with Bill. The eighth step after I did it, and he and I talked about all of the stuff before nine, I discovered that the fourth step was those were the weapons that I used on people. Those defects were my weapons. And the eighth step was sort of my hit list. Those people I would go after, those people I would operate against or at, or the scapegoats I would use. So I had my weapons and I know how I used them on those people. And I made most of my ninth step amends. An awful lot of those people, I did not even know their names any longer because they weren't that important to me. And I know the ones that I haven't done. And, that was 45 plus years ago. If they're still alive, if I ever run into them, yeah, we'll talk. And then Bill put me on 10, 11, and 12, which is where I try and live today. I take an inventory absolutely daily, kind of constantly. It's not that I sit down and write every day, but I certainly do think about my actions before anything big or important and after. And when there are disagreements, I try and make sure that I've taken care of the problem and let somebody know where I was wrong and try and fix things. And it happens. I'm not perfect and I'll never be perfect. My 11th step, prayer and meditation. I'm never going to stop seeking. I read four, five, six things, I think, every morning. Other stuff during the day, I'm at meetings. And the culmination of everything we do is in a sense the 12th step. We've had a spiritual awakening. Mine started the first day I didn't drink. I try to carry the message. Today I do service in my group. I sponsor people. My phone number is out there all over the place to talk to people, and I put myself out there. I'm trying to give back what was given to me. And man, I try and do what I'm supposed to do in this program. Dan is my sponsor. Got to tell you, he's the nicest guy going. And I try and live today the way I would expect my friends in the program, Dan and Bruce and Dave and Scott and all the guys I sponsor and know well and love. I try and live the way they would expect me to live. I try and behave the way and try and act the way my dog thinks I am. Little dog runs down the hall, tail wagging, loving me, and I try and live like I've got something to do with that. I'm running out of stuff to say. I just want to thank you guys so much for listening to me today. It's funny, the last time I told my story, my internet went out and I never really got to finish it completely. The time before that, I was speaking at an anniversary for a guy I sponsored in New York, and he had 10 years and I was dying. Just so happy, pleased he asked me to speak. And it was on Zoom. And then all of a sudden, all of these people celebrating 1 year showed up. So he told me I needed to speak for 30 minutes. I think I got about 4 minutes to tell my story. So this is the longest time I have ever spent telling my story, and it's got to be seven, six, 7 years. And thanks to the opportunity, Dan, thanks for voluntolding me. And Jim, thanks for the shepherding through this thing. It's great to be here, and don't drink and go to the meetings. It works.